Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
Poet and photographer Marianne Werner has a BA in English from San Diego State University, an MA in creative writing from Syracuse University, and a JD from the University of San Diego. She is passionate about travel and nature and writes poems inspired by nature photographs. Simple Images was her first book, which combined poems and photographs. She has a second collection of poems and photos entitled Moments. And her newest book of just poems is called Findings. She'll be reading some of her poems at the Women's Club on October 18th. Marianne Werner, welcome.
Thanks, Nancy. Nice to be here.
You know, I'm reading your poems and looking at a photograph on the facing page, and I kind of wonder which came first.
It's hard to say. A lot of them were simultaneous. Sometimes I get inspired by a scene in nature that I see, but very, very few times have I had to seek out a photo to go with a poem. So they kind of come together.
Well, I could see some of these photographs. You might have just walked out in your yard or taken a walk here in Chico, but you don't limit yourself to just Northern California. You go all over the world.
Well, I like to think that I've gotten out of my house quite a bit.
Well, your photograph of hydrangeas, was that taken here locally?
That was taken in Brookings, Oregon, where we spend part of the year. We have a home there.
Well, one thing I enjoy about your photographs are they're close-ups. I mean, except there are, of course, exceptions. Snow geese are up in the sky.
Yeah.
But your photographs of flowers or grapes, and carrots.
Mm-hmm.
I love the close-ups. Now, did you have help with the formatting of this book?
The formatting would not have turned out the way it did without the help of Dennis Wicks, who is a retired digital photography teacher and artist from Butte College. Dennis is my right-hand person in putting things together, and he did a great job on the book.
Well, I wish the listeners could see these beautiful. What color describe them for the listeners?
Well, the hydrangeas are various shades of purple, and the one in the book is kind of a dark lavender more than anything, I would say.
And the leaves, there's not a flaw in the leaves. How do you find such perfect?
It was a perfect moment for this flower.
Why don't you read us that poem, Hydrangeas, in your book? And the book, this collection is called Moments. They are poems and photographs that you have collected, and
Hydrangeas. I can't get enough of them. At the nursery, in my garden, even stopping along the roadside just to look at their enormous segmented blooms, puffs of purple, pink, white, lavender, four-petaled speck of a yellow center. Our Oregon coast climate is hydrangea perfect, and the ones I plant with rusted nails, adding iron to the soil for deeper purpling. Sometimes at night, I imagine I'm in a claw-footed tub of scented water, surrounded by bobbing, listing hydrangeas, such cushioning those purple globes grazing my knee.
This is poet and photographer Marianne Werner reading from her collection Moments. And you, since I mentioned the geese, because a lot of your photographs of nature are close-ups, geese an exception to that, snow geese. You wrote a poem, and was this taken locally?
This was taken. I was going down to the wildlife reserve at Gray Lodge in Gridley, and I happened to pull along the highway because I saw a whole field of these geese, and I had my camera, and as I got out of the car, they took off. So I just started clicking.
Because they are so thick.
Yeah.
I don't know that I've ever in reality seen such a thick flock of geese.
It's an amazing experience.
Well, read us that poem.
Snow geese. Witness the sudden explosion. Thousands of white, black-tipped wings. Snow geese simultaneously lifting. A surging blur of feathers. Geese murmuring, muttering. I cannot breathe for joy. As if my body is bursting through my skin. My arms extending, undulating. Soaring fingertips grazing wingtips, wings gliding. I am sheer, lighter than air.
And I can just imagine how moving it would be to see these birds.
Yeah, when I think about it, I can still feel that it's a physical sensation. I mean, it was just a moment of exuberance more than anything. And that's, I think that's what characterizes most of these. There was a moment in time when something happened that was so memorable that through the photograph or through the poem, I felt like I needed to preserve it some way.
So when you're writing, you don't just go off somewhere in a room and say, okay, now I'm going to write a poem.
Well, no, not really. I mean, once I get the beginnings of a poem, I work that way as the follow-up. But the poems seem to happen as I'm traveling or as I see something. My eyes are tuned to what's going on and you know, trying to see something that may not be of the ordinary.
Well, one poem of yours that I read, it struck me that I could just imagine myself when I am in a place where there are a lot of people that I kind of concoct a story. What must the story mm-hmm. of this person be? Mm-hmm. So I could understand you're writing the poem that you call At the Post Office. That I just imagine that, yeah, Marianne, you were at the post office and you saw this person.
Absolutely, I did. And I read what was on the package that was written on this kind of, you know, the when you used to wrap a package in a brown paper bag, that's what was written on the package. And I just imagined what her life was or where this was going, and I couldn't tell.
Did you actually speak to her? Or
no,
this is all
I was standing behind her in line at the post office. So,
and reading the address. On
who says you can't find a poem at the post office?
Well, you proved that you can. Would you read that? That's
sure.
On page 58 of your collection, Findings.
At the post office. She is young and holding a package wrapped in clear plastic over brown paper, decorated with brightly colored stickers of flowers and red hearts. Addressed to Juan Ramos somewhere in Iraq, she lists his military code numbers, customs papers, contents. I wonder, wife, sister, girlfriend? Shock for Juan Ramos. The red-hot red sky over southern Iraq explodes. Embedded there in desert sand in his mouth, he watches missiles irradiate white, finger nerve endings gripping his rifle. Bomb rattled, he hears distant calls to prayer 5 times daily. Awe for Juan Ramos, precision cluster bombings, surgically strike a bus in Syria, a child with shrapnel in his spine, surgical, the IV drip, dark brown long-lashed eyes, surgically strike a market in Baghdad, 62 dead shoppers. And I imagine Juan Ramos poised, camouflaged, expectant, opening the flowered package in his tent, butterscotch, lock of brown hair, dice, metal cross, pictures, hand soap, red bandana, lucky penny. My wish for Juan Ramos, that he could see a black clouded sky, late winter, dark billowed blue horizon, cold, 3 white swans startled from behind golden long-speared tule lake grasses, lift mutely into flight, 1, 2, 3 balanced wings, easing them up and into a calm and perfect grace.
This is Marianne Werner reading her poem At the Post Office. And I think it's easier if you can see the poem to look back and say, oh, shock and awe, if they missed it when they were listening to you reading that. Shock for Juan Ramos and awe for Juan Ramos. And then I thought it was so characteristic of you that what you feel bad about is he's missing the beautiful nature, being stuck in a place where there's just desert.
Yep.
Well, the poem that takes us back quite a long time. And I don't know if people know that in the 1600s, there was this strange bubble that occurred. And you don't have a photograph in your collection Findings, but in your other book, Moments, you have this page of beautiful tulips.
The tulips, yes.
Where did you take the picture of the tulips?
The tulip pictures came from Woodburn, Oregon. There's a tulip farm outside south of Portland in Woodburn, Oregon, and they're just tulips forever, tulips forever.
Well, this was a strange thing that happened concerning tulips in, you say, in your book, 1637. What happened in 1637?
Well, there was a, it was called Tulipomania, and they started putting together odd variations of tulips, and it was like a, I don't want to call it the housing bubble, but it was a flower bubble, and people invested fortunes in these tulips, and eventually it burst. And they created all kinds of things, and many, many people, I mean, I don't want to say like the stock market, but tulips were that valuable in the 1600s. This was in 1637, called the Dutch Golden Age.
Yeah, you say it peaked in 1637. And I happened to ask a friend if he was familiar with tulipomania. And he was, this war of the tulips. And he was excited about it because he thought it was really interesting that the people fought a war. And this was the first, before we had housing bubbles,
right.
There was this tulip bubble.
Yep.
Well, read us the War of the Tulips.
The War of the Tulips. Meanwhile, the tulips aligned without confrontation. Planted by rows, bordering gardens, clumped in parks, unaware of a war bearing their name. They simply opened, revealing centered geometric patterns, floral stigmatas, painted black, yellow, red, while splaying tulip petals exposed delicate thin pistils. Petals illuminated orange, pink, violet, permutated, became luxury items, streaked speculation, white, purple, green, blue-pink, intuited when in spring to unfold, after daffodils, before irises, purest colors, a spectrum of flaunting glass fists that, if frozen, would shatter into 1,000 splinters of soft, broken tulip.
Marianne Werner is reading The War of the Tulips from her newest collection of poems, Findings. There is, while we're overseas, abroad, there's a story that you tell, and you even write it more like a story. And this is, it takes place in South Africa, the transplant. And when I read this, you tell us it's a true story, but I thought, oh my gosh, how could that possibly be? This is on page 51 in your book, The Transplant. And like I said, this takes place in South Africa.
The actual story I read in a book called My Traitor's Heart by Ryan Milan, who was a South African writer. And according to him, it was a true story. And it's called The Transplant. And you have to remember that the war between black Africans and white South Africaners has been going on for so long. And it's something that is still happening today. But when I read this, it just sort of froze me. And it's a narrative poem. It's not a, which is a poem really without the line breaks, and it's almost like a paragraph. It's called The Transplant, South Africa, a true story. The white Afrikaner had died in violence, and his widow wanted him to stay alive. So she donated his still beating heart to a man so sick he would soon die. But the transplanted heart gave him life. It pumped blood through his veins, and he moved his arms, his legs with new oxygen. But when the dead man's parents realized their son's heart had gone into the chest of a black man, they screamed. They wanted the heart returned, and they asked the surgeon to transplant the heart back to their dead son, leaving the once fortunate recipient without even a used heart.
That's just so hard to believe.
I know.
That emotions would be so strong that a family would do that.
And they still are.
Well, let's go back to some flowers.
Okay.
You have a poem called Distant Light, and you mentioned Van Gogh. This is early in your collection. This is on page 8 of your collection, Findings.
This was really kind of inspired several years ago. I was fortunate enough to see a major Van Gogh exhibit in Paris, and I was overwhelmed with Van Gogh after that, so this poem came out of that experience. It's called Distant Light. Van Gogh reassembled nature, stroked green and yellow on canvas, brushed blue sky across dark horizons, shaded fire stalks of wheat and blackbirds in flight, each a rippled, lilting V. He grasped starry night, stippled a vast puzzle of swirls on fire, daubed blue-black diamond glittering solar tails, and the moon, fat sliver of itself, sunbound. He purpled irises bordering vast gardens, sweeping a thick clutch across his canvas in the asylum at St. Remy. Pale green reeds, irises tinctured pure lavender, quivering blossoms as alive as raw spring. Van Gogh made sunflowers, sunflowers, brown-faced yellow petals feather wide dark centers, some scratched to seed, their sturdy stems bent or turned furred leaves, curling dry, three stalks, 12, 15 cut in vases, sunflowers, as if they were his name, golden blades shifting as they do, drawn to distant light.
And that's the name of this poem, Distant Light, by Marianne Werner. And you don't, this in this collection, you don't have photographs, but we're familiar enough, I think your readers are familiar enough with Van Gogh, mm-hmm. that they can see in their mind's eye what you're writing yeah. about in this poem.
Hard to miss a Van Gogh sunflower.
Yes, it is. Now, a couple of pages over, you have That Dark Light.
That Dark Night is a poem that kind of was inspired by a couple of things. One, I heard a statement by, I think a reading on public radio, an interview by Michael Longley, who's a poet from Northern Ireland, and he said, "My heart stops when I discover an orchid."
I might ask you to repeat, where did you hear this, Marianne?
On North State Public Radio, I think. So the idea of his heart stopping when he discovered an orchid reminded me of the first time I saw the Northern Lights. I had visited there a couple of years ago and was just breathless. I mean, still breathless. And so this is kind of combining those two experiences. That dark night. Curve of soft petal, center fused, stamen and carpel, the lip pollen enticing, the symmetry of leaves, parallel veined, thousands of distinct variations, dancing lady, pink butterfly, moth, sun-kissed butter, jewel, cockle shell. In Iceland, I saw aurora borealis, shifting pale whirls of fog, clouds swirling into shapes, transforming in an eye blink, tinging night, green, purple, orange. But when 25 seconds lapsed, shutter of my camera, poised skyward, tripod still waiting, focused to infinity, when it captured a shining palette of green-orange luminescence spread against a jagged mountain horizon, a spilling of hues saturating that dark night, it was as if I had arrived mid-starburst in the universe, crashing the Milky Way.
Marianne Werner is reading That Dark Night. And this is from her collection of poems, Findings. And, you know, Marianne, I'm sometimes so moved by, sometimes it would happen to be an exhibit by Monet in San Francisco or something beautiful in nature. And it moves me to tears sometimes, and I almost feel embarrassed. Oh, no. Gosh. So I imagine that a lot of times you're looking at these things, at least by yourself, so that you maybe don't put yourself in the situation I find myself.
Well,
sometimes.
No, but they become a part of who you are, I think, those experiences.
Well, thank you for putting this collection together, these two collections. And I think you might just inspire other people to, when they are moved by nature, to write it down.
And photographs and poems are perfect.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah,
Nancy.
Marianne Werner, her latest collection of poems, Moments, Poems and Photographs, and Findings. After a break, Karen Sinnell brings us the history of murals in the San Francisco Bay Area. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. Thank you. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. Author Karen Norton Sinnell has 27 years of photographic experience, exhibiting in the Bay Area and Northern California galleries and shows since 1996. She's won local and international awards for her photography. After graduating from the University of Montana with degrees in education and design, Karen Sinnell was exposed to art history in Vienna, Austria, and continued her studies at the New York Institute of Photography. Her work is on permanent display at the Chico History Museum, and she has two published books, Frescoes by the Bay, Art, Artists, and Their Stories, Volumes 1 and 2. These art history publications document life through the eyes of famous and not-so-famous muralists, whose work is found in unexpected places in the San Francisco Bay Area. Karen Sinnell, welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
This is such a monumental task that you undertook and such beautiful results. How did you get interested in frescoes?
Believe it or not, it started way back in 1989. I was living in San Francisco at the time, and I saw an advertisement in Sunset Magazine about a walking tour of some murals. And I just thought that sounded like something fun and kind of offbeat to do that was out of the ordinary. And so I went. And when I was done with the tour, I wanted to buy a book about it because I was taken back by how much history was involved. It was unexpected for me. And of course they said, well, we don't have a book. And I'm like, okay, so can I get your brochure? And they're like, well, we don't have a brochure. So I'm like, well, how can I learn more about these? And they said, well, I think there's a list at the public library. So I went over there, and sure enough, I had a typewritten list. And I just started going around on weekends and photographing them. And of course, I quickly discovered that many of the buildings, either the murals had been painted over or the building itself had actually been destroyed. And it wasn't until I stumbled across the small selection of murals that are done in the true fresco format that I knew that those were still all in existence and they were still available for public viewing. So that became my focus.
Well, I was surprised at my own ignorance of the process of making a fresco. I had no idea how involved it is. And you just used a term, true fresco. So if there's such a thing as a true fresco, there must be something that is in contrast to that. And you used Italian terms to designate these two different kinds of frescoes. What did you learn?
Well, buon fresco means true fresco. And really what that is you take a dry pigment and you apply it to a freshly laid wet plaster wall. And that pigment absorbs into the wall and it's really a permanent part of the architecture at that point. There's a second type of fresco, and that type is the opposite, where the wall itself is dry and then you add a wet pigment, but it doesn't soak in the same, so it can flake off much easier.
And so there you have a buon fresco, which is a true fresco. And
yes.
Then you have a dry fresco, al secco fresco.
Al secco, yes.
Yeah, and you chose to focus on the true fresco. And you, in your book, you mentioned a couple of reasons you chose to focus on the true fresco. And what were those reasons?
Well, I was impressed with what a laborious process it really is. I mean, you can paint a mural on any surface with any kind of medium, but a fresco is very specific and very labor intensive. It's at least three coats of plaster, and you have to mix it just right so each coat adheres to each other. And then the very last coat, you have to make sure it's very smooth. And you can only do about a 2-foot section when you go to paint it, because the wall has to be damp enough to absorb the dry pigment, but it also can't be, you don't want the wall to dry too fast. So it's you have a very small window of opportunity to actually paint it.
In fact, I found the whole process so fascinating that I read it to a friend of mine who had lived in Rome for years, and he was familiar with these steps. They were all new to me, but it was so involved. You have to go on page after page just describing how a fresco is made.
Yes. Just mixing all of the pigments and the grinding of them, and then the testing with a drop of water, if it floats or if it sinks, determines if the pigment is ready, and then they continue to grind it. And it takes a whole team of skilled craftsmen to actually make it happen.
My guest is Karen Norton-Sinnell. She has a two-volume work called Frescoes by the Bay, Art, Artists, and Their Stories. And in my own head, I hadn't really separated, I was surprised to find, murals from frescoes. I was familiar with Diego Rivera and his murals, but I hadn't really made a distinction between murals and frescoes. Do you find other people kind of equate those?
Yeah, a lot of people ask me, well, what is a fresco? They don't really know. And like I said, a mural can be painted on any surface. It could be wood, it could be stucco, it could be metal, and it could be painted with oils or egg tempera, any kind of medium. Fresco is very specific with the plaster, and it does become a part of the architectural integrity of the building.
Another thing that surprised me is, speaking of Rivera, I just imagine he was there working by himself, and he does this work by himself. And yet there's a whole staff of people who cooperate in creating a fresco. It takes so many people. It's not just the work of one person.
No, they have the color grinders. They have the crew that does the plaster. And he usually has other people helping draw it on the wall, the Sinopia, and that's the outline. And then when it comes to painting the main figures, that's the part that he does by himself.
Well, I mentioned Diego Rivera because he happened to be a familiar name, but some names that were not familiar, their stories were so fascinating. And I was so glad you told us about these people. I would like to just start with, it's volume two, but your whole work is the two volumes are a continuation. Book two is a continuation of the first one. And I would like to go to the history of medicine, a mural that depicts the history of medicine. This is in your book two. Where can people see these murals?
Those are done at UCSF Medical Center on Parnassus Avenue in San Francisco. And it is in Tolan Hall. And last time I was there, about 30 days ago, it was under construction. You could still get to it. It just was a little more difficult. It was a little bit like a labyrinth trying to get there. But they're all still in existence, and you are allowed to go view them.
Well, who was the author? The artist.
Bernard Zackheim was the artist, and he came over from Poland, and he worked at Coit Tower first. He did a mural there called The Library, and then he was contracted to do UCSF History of Medicine.
Well, since we can't see these beautiful pictures that you have in your book, these murals, why don't you describe, for example, you have one there in this section, various doctors. Would you describe for us what the listeners can't see right now?
Of course. There are several different doctors who are prominent during that time period, and the medical school, they learned how to contain botulism by canning foods, and of course that expanded the canning industry all over the United States. They discovered what vitamin E does for our health. They figured out how to stop the bubonic plague. One of my favorite stories, though, was more personal about just being able to enter into school at that time. And of course, it was really a male-dominated field. So if you look at the far left side of the mural, there's a woman, we're talking back in the 1800s, so she has her long dress on and her boots. And her name was Dr. Lucy Wassner. And she applied to medical school. And the founder of the school thought she was crazy. And he looked at her and he said, if you want to go to medical school, you ought to have your ovaries removed. Well, she didn't like that one bit. So she turned around and replied and said, well, the male students then ought to have their testicles removed. So if you look closely at the mural, she's got something in each hand. And in one hand is testes and the other hand is ovaries.
So. Yeah, it looks like such a serious mural that we wouldn't suspect there was humor hidden in this mural.
There's lots of humor in, and there's love affairs and there's scandals and there's lots of politics. You have to look really closely. And one of my favorite things is they're so detailed that even as much as I've studied them, often when I go back to them, I feel like I see something new, or if I share it with someone else, they came up with something that, you know, I didn't even notice. So they're very fun to go back to over and over again.
Well, and that's why we need your commentary, because there's so much we would miss in these murals if we didn't have your commentary. The fact that there's a woman doctor in the mural, and the fact that how she's dressed, mm-hmm. and these figures that are depicted are people that would be recognized in that day. Now, what's the time period we're talking about for these murals, Karen?
The murals were painted in the 30s, and it really started with President Roosevelt, and it was after the Depression, and various different programs, the largest known one was the Work Progress Administrative, started putting starving artists back to work. And then from there were some private contracts with different artists, and it really came from right after the Mexican mural movement down there in our close proximity and that to Diego Rivera. So they kind of mimicked it to get people back to work.
In fact, I years ago looked at the murals of Diego Rivera at the University of Mexico, and I wish I had read your book before I looked at those murals, because I did so much I missed by being so unfamiliar with this whole process.
Yeah, I've never seen them. I would love to someday.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'll continue my conversation with Karen Norton-Sennell, author of Frescoes by the Bay. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guest is award-winning photographer Karen Sennell, who's author of Frescoes by the Bay. Did you know when you started out that you were going to need to do two volumes, Karen?
Not necessarily. I always knew that the images needed to be full-page spreads, but I was trying to save money initially, so the initial mock-up all the images are very tiny, so it was one book. And it was a marketing decision to do the two volumes for two reasons. One is price point. With two volumes, you could buy either one for $40 each, or if there was only one volume, then you're stuck with paying $80, and that might be more than you're able to afford. So that was one reason. And the second reason is having two volumes, they're small enough that you could take them with you if you go to view them.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and read the story along with it.
In fact, as I'm reading your books, your two volumes, I'm thinking, oh gosh, I want to go down and look at some of these murals, because just informal survey, I'm surprised that other people are as unfamiliar as I was with this wealth of murals in San Francisco, in the Bay Area, this whole Bay Area.
Yeah, I was too. And that's really how it started. I stumbled across something that seemed to be obscure and unknown. And I didn't understand why, because I thought it was historically significant.
Oh, yeah. We have just talked about the history of medicine, the murals by Bernard Zakheim. And this is in volume two of your book. And these murals can be found at the UCSF Medical Center. So Bernard Zakheim was a name I was unfamiliar with, and were surprised at how interesting his work is on the history of medicine.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in book one, you have some murals that can be found at Coit Tower. And I think perhaps if people are familiar with any of these murals, frescoes, it might be the ones at Coit Tower.
I agree. That seems to be the most well-known venue.
Yeah. And tell us about the artist that created these murals, these frescoes.
Well, actually, Coit Tower was a combination of 26 artists altogether. They got together and they were assigned different wall spaces and they were assigned different subjects. And some of them had a knowledge of their subject, and other of the artists had absolutely no knowledge of their subject, and they all had to go out and research it and then come up with a plan and submit it to the board. Now, my book doesn't represent all 26 artists, and that is because, again, my book focuses on the bone fresco, true fresco process. At Coit Tower, there are some murals down by the elevator that are done oil on canvas. They're beautiful. They're wonderful to look at. They just don't happen to be in my book because they're not fresco. And then there is one upstairs that was done in egg tempura, and I also did not include that one.
Well, one thing I notice as I open this section called Powell Street is they have some ladies very elegantly dressed. Now, there's a policeman in the picture, but I notice how elegant these ladies were. How did that come about?
Well, the artist for that one is Lucien Lebeau, and he was born over in Paris, and he was a dressmaker. And so he was very attuned to buttons and collars and stitching and bows and hats and everything. And you can see it in the details of his clothing. And it's just beautiful. One of the reasons I like this is I wanted to be a clothing designer myself when I was younger. But also, if you look very closely on the little Presto Serve cart, it has a license plate, just like a car or a motorcycle or anything else would have a license
plate. You might explain what you mean by that little motorized vehicle.
They serve food out of it, but it's equivalent to a trailer. And if you have a trailer, you have to put a license plate on it. And during that time period, my grandfather actually made the California license plates. He had a 10-year contract from 1929 to 1939. They did not go to the prisons till 1947. He also made many of the street signs that you see throughout the murals.
So we're particularly interested in the fact that within this mural is a little license plate. There's also a sticker next to that, a piece of luggage that has White Star Line, Transatlantic, and Paris on there. So there's another Lucien made that connection with where he was born in that mural.
Yes, absolutely.
Now, what about the other two? Besides the stylishly dressed women, and there's a man there, there's a policeman, and then there's a guy there in a, I guess I'd call it a uniform. What does he represent?
Well, he's a porter, and he's helping carry the luggage, primarily for the women. And he's helping them get from their transportation to the hotel room.
And the ladies and their clothes are very clearly depicted. And, of course, in the background, there's Powell Hotel, for example.
Mm-hmm.
My guest is Karen Sinnell. She has a two-volume book, a set, Frescoes by the Bay, Art, Artists, and Their Stories. And she's been telling us about the process of making frescoes and how complicated it really is and why she chose to focus on true frescoes, called buon fresco, as opposed to al secco fresco, which is painted dry. And we have Franklin Delano Roosevelt to thank, really, for these frescoes, don't you think?
Yes, we do. It really was all about him. He knew he wanted to have some kind of a program to help people get back to work after the Great Depression. And he actually talked to his roommate in college about it. And it was his roommate that suggested that they do public art the way Mexico had done. And so they approached people in the government, and they got it passed through quite quickly. And San Francisco was one of the prime locations because of its vicinity to Mexico and, of course, our weather.
You know, one image surprised me because I've played tennis most of my life, and there is a likeness of a tennis champion in one of the murals. I was really surprised because this is the 1930s now.
Yes.
So where do we find a, who was this tennis player, by the way?
Her name was Helen.
Wills Moody.
Yes, Wills Moody. Thank you. And she won, I believe it was eight Wimbledon titles.
Yes, eight singles titles. Uh-huh.
Yeah, and she is portrayed as a mother of earth goddess in one of Diego Rivera's murals that resides in the Stock Exchange Tower in San Francisco.
So now we've moved on to the San Francisco Stock Exchange Tower, and the artist is Diego Rivera. And what else is in that picture with Helen Wills Moody?
Well, like I said, she's portrayed as kind of a goddess of Mother Nature, and she has a necklace of golden wheat around her neck, and in one hand she's holding a lot of the agricultural fruits and vegetables that we have in our state, and the other hand is actually pulling back the earth because she's showing underneath there how they go in and mine for gold. But if you look closely at the mural, it actually depicts all three methods of trying to get gold. One is extracting it from the earth. The other one is dredging it out of riverbeds. And you can see the dredger in the background and the pilings of tailings off to the side. And then you can see
James Marshall
down in the corner panning for gold. And, of course, he's the one that discovered it in 1848.
Mm-hmm. At Sutter's Mill. Yeah. It started the gold rush. Yeah. So he is in this painting. And then in the center stands a guy with an airplane in his hand.
Yeah, that is Ralph Stackpole's son. And the reason he's holding an airplane is we had a lot of advancement in aviation during that time, and a lot of it came out of Crissy Field.
My guest is Karen Sinnell. She has a two-volume set of books, Frescoes by the Bay, Art, Artists, and Their Stories. And she has just been telling us about a mural by Diego Rivera, who is a famous muralist. And the paintings and all these murals are so full of information that you are saying it takes a long time. You can go back and look at a mural and see things you missed the first two or three or four or five times you looked at them. So that section was called Allegory of California, and those that mural is found at the Stock Exchange Tower. And then also in Book 1, Volume 1, you have Peacetime Activities of the Army. And where are these murals found, these frescoes?
Now, those reside in the Presidio. There's a little chapel at the top knoll, and they went in. Victor Arnotoff is the artist, and he went in and painted those. And you can see in the background that they would fight fires when that was going on. We took part in the Gatun Locks down in the Panama Canal, the building of that. And one of the main features is the building of the Golden Gate Bridge. And in the mural, you can see that the engineer, Joseph B. Strauss, is trying to present his model of it. And the general there has a frown on his face because the original design for the Golden Gate Bridge called for the destruction of Fort Point, and they didn't want to do that. The military did not like that idea at all. So Strauss had to go back to the drawing board and redesign it with an arch over Fort Point to keep it there.
And so this mural also has a lot of information in it. To the right, the guys with their fedoras and shovels in their hands. In the background is a fire raging. And then you have these three men looking at the plans for the San Francisco Bay Bridge, or the Golden Gate Bridge, rather. And then there's some other men look like they're planning a building over on the right.
That's actually the Panama Canal and the Gatun Locks. Mm-hmm. They're looking at the plans for that, and they're showing how the gates open.
The locks, yeah. And you have a close-up next to that that painting. And who was the artist for this, the Peacetime Activities of the Army in the Presidio Chapel?
It's Victor Arnotoff.
And what do we know about him?
He came over, I believe, from Russia, and he also participated at Coit Tower. And I'm sorry, that's all I remember.
Well, you have a lot of artists in there. You must have a favorite. Who is your favorite?
They're all my favorite for different reasons and different ways. I do love Victor Arnotoff's mural here at the Presidio because it depicts the Ohlone Indians, which originally inhabited that land. But every artist just has something different in how they portray people or happenings in their painting, or there's a story in one of them. So it's very hard for me. People ask me that all the time. You know, where should I go? The one place I should go, or which book should I buy if I'm only going to buy one? And I can't tell them because there's something wonderful about all of them.
And you mentioned some of the people depicted like Native Americans. One section is farmer and cowboy. Mm-hmm. So it really is a history lesson, too, I think, because people who look at these murals will begin to wonder, well, what's the story behind this mural and who are those people? And do you find that's the case, that people want to dig into history?
Yes, and it's actually a lot of the reason that I wrote it the way that I did, because murals originally were designed for instruction of the illiterate. So I wrote the book with very straight prose. So somebody who reads it does not have to be an art historian, know anything about fresco. They can just dig into the book and they can learn as they go.
Well, I do think people want to tuck a copy of both copies under their arm and when they make a trip to the Bay Area. Thank you so much, Karen.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Karen Sinnell compiled photographs, beautiful photographs of murals, and the title of her two-volume series is Frescoes by the Bay, Art, Artists, and Their Stories. I'd also like to thank my first guest, Marianne Werner, whose two books are Moments and Findings. And just a reminder that Marianne Werner will have a book signing at the Women's Club in Chico on October 18th. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.